Hi, hello. Welcome to Mary's Cup of Tea, the self-love podcast for women, though all self-lovers are welcome here. I'm Mary. I write and speak about self-love, and I'm best known for my book, The Gift of Self-Love, and I also host retreats for women. And this is the podcast that will inspire you to love yourself. Real quick, before we dive in, I want to make sure you know about my book, The Gift of Self-Love. It's a workbook to help you build confidence, recognize your worth, and learn to love who you are. It's available anywhere books are sold. Thousands of people have it, love it, and have told me that it has greatly benefited their self-love journey, and I hope it'll do the same for you. And now let's get into the podcast. This special episode is jam-packed and juicy, something I've been wanting to try for a while, which is a best of series, like Best of Mary's Cup of Tea, where I dug through over 250 recordings to compile clips from some of my favorite conversations. We'll cover topics surrounding self-love, of course, including body image, mental health, mindset, confidence, relationships, and women's empowerment as a whole. I hope that this series can be like a little self-love starter kit for you if you're new here, or a refresher if you're a seasoned self-lover. Either way, you'll walk away with concrete tools, newfound inspiration, and hopefully a reminder of how worthy you are of self-love. If something speaks to you and you want to dive deeper, you can find the links to the original episodes in the show notes. So let's start at the place where this all began for me, with a topic very near and dear to my heart, which is eating disorder recovery and intuitive eating for women who are done with diet culture. Or if you're not done yet, you're going to be done with diet culture by the time I'm done with you. That sounded a little threatening. You know what I mean.
So wherever you're at on your journey, there are some diet cultured habits / behaviors and some things that we've been brainwashed to do subconsciously because of beauty standards and fat phobia and all of that fun stuff that we know about, but sometimes it's a little bit difficult to actually put it into practice, especially these little pesky habits that we've been doing for so long, like probably since childhood. So of course, it's going to take a little bit of time for us to stop doing them. But the first step is to admit to ourselves that we're doing them. And how this episode came up is I am actually doing a 10-week voice coaching program, and I'm studying a technique called Fitzmaurice voice work. It's a group class over Zoom, and it's all about creating room in your body so that your voice has a place to reverberate. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's basically about expanding the channels in your body. So it involves a lot of like mind, body, breath kind of connection where you're literally letting go of tension in the body so that your voice comes naturally and you feel more present in the moment and you just feel empowered by the way you speak. You might be able to tell that I just came from voice class, or maybe not because it's only my third class. But in that class today, a woman unmuted herself to ask a question about holding in your stomach. And she's like, is it just me? Or I'm more prone to hold in my stomach while I'm standing and it's harder for me to let it go than it is when I'm sitting. And it just hit me how so many women, especially, and this, she is not the first person to talk about holding in her stomach during this voice class. And the people who were talking about it were all women. And the class is actually majority men. So it just kind of highlighted that we are just so trained to hold in our stomachs at all time. And especially when we're standing, we just feel this need to clench, right? And I think that clenching is symbolic of the greater picture, is that we're trying to take up less space and we're trying to make ourselves smaller and we're trying to stay in control, right? Whether that control is of our bodies or of other people's perceptions of our bodies. We just have been trained to suck in our stomach. So that is the first habit that I'm going to bring up to you. And you probably know you're doing it. To be honest with you, sometimes I do it. And actually, not sometimes, all of these things that I'm talking to you about today are things that I've caught myself doing recently. So I'm not talking to you like some saint, and I don't do these things because I also live in a society that's been brainwashed by diet culture and fat phobia. I'm just starting to become like hyper aware of these things, and I'm able to like quickly catch myself and shift into something else. For example, relaxing my stomach. So I invite you to do that right now. Relax your stomach. This is something that I've learned in yoga. There are times when, yeah, you have to like hold in your core a little bit to do certain poses. And maybe if you're an athlete of some sort, there's certain things you might be doing where holding in your core isn't like a beauty standard thing. It's just a functional thing, right? And just like I learned in yoga, there are times when you get to let go and let yourself breathe. And if you think about how long we've been holding in our stomachs, that is restricting your literal airflow. So cut that shit out. You deserve to breathe and breathe deeply. On that note, I'm going to take a dramatic sip of tea to let that message sink in.
The next clip is from a really fun conversation with Dr. Anita Johnston, a clinical psychologist who's been treating eating disorders for over 35 years. She uses stories and metaphors to speak to the subconscious mind. And here I asked her to share her famous log metaphor.
It's my favorite. And the reason it's my favorite is that I still get emails from people all over the world saying this one story helped me change my perception about what was going on with me and food. And so because of that, that's my favorite now. So of course, with these metaphors, you use your imagination, which again, a lot of people say, oh, I don't have a good imagination. And I like to say, what do you think worry is, right? Worry is a bad use of a good imagination, right? So with these metaphors, you're using this faculty and you imagine yourself on the banks of a raging river and you fall in. Pouring down rain, you slip, you fall in, you're drowning, you're getting pulled down through the rapids, and along comes a big log and you grab on, and that log saves your life. It keeps your head above water when surely you would have drowned, and eventually it carries you to a place in the river where the water is calm, and from there you can see the riverbank, but you can't get there because you're holding onto the log. So the irony of it is the very thing that just saved your life is now getting in the way of you going where you want to go in life. And to make it more complicated, there's always someone on the riverbank yelling, let go of the log, let go of the log. And you feel like an absolute idiot because you can't let go of the log. The way I see it is letting go of that log may not be the best thing to do initially. Because what happens if you let go of that log, swim to shore, and get halfway there and realize, oh, shoot, I don't have the strength or confidence to make it. Well, now you're really sunk because that means you don't have the strength to make it back to the log either. So I believe there's this wise part of ourselves that will not let us let go of anything until we're good and ready. So what do you do instead? Well, you let go of the log and you try floating. And as soon as you start to sink, you grab back on. And then you let go of the log and you practice treading water. And when you get tired, you grab back on. Then you let go of the log and you swim around it once, grab back on, twice, grab back on, 10 times, 100 times, 200 times, whatever it takes for you to have the strength and confidence to make it to shore. Then you let go of the log because you see, it doesn't have a job anymore. And so I use this analogy with people who are struggling with disordered eating, because a lot of times they think that they're doing what they do with food because there's something wrong with them. They're damaged, they're broken in some way. And they don't understand that, no, whatever you're doing has a function, a very important function, and it would behoove you to find out what it is. It could very well have kept you from drowning in some strong emotional currents.
So how do you know if you're ready to let go of the proverbial log? Here's Christy Harrison, intuitive eating counselor and anti-diet dietitian, on when it might be time to start healing your relationship with food and your body and what that process might feel like.
You've probably worked with a lot more people on this, but what is it that like really keeps people stuck in a disordered relationship with food besides our capitalistic fatphobic culture and the air and society that we live and breathe in every day?
I mean that largely, yeah.
Maybe.
For sure. But I think also like getting to the point in your life where the bad of the eating disorder outweighs the good. You know, it's kind of like what they say for all kinds of recovery, like just getting to the point where the process or the addiction or whatever it is, you know, the eating disorder in this case is just taking more from your life than it's giving you. And not even the eating disorder, like doesn't have to be a diagnosed eating disorder, right? It could be chronic dieting. It could be just, you know, constant fight in your relationship with your body. It's whenever you get to that point where the harms and the pain of that is outweighing whatever benefits you've gotten from a diet, whether it's, you know, greater access to thin privilege and sort of a feeling of more acceptance in society or praise from friends and family and strangers and the internet, you know, people, I've seen people who are influencers who like have a whole business and brand built around that. And so then, you know, having to let that go can be really hard. Mm-hmm. But even just, you know, everyday people whose doctors are praising them or spouses and partners are praising them, you know, like that kind of stuff is unfortunately very reinforcing. And so, you know, I think getting to a point where the pain of disordered eating, of constantly fighting with your body, of fighting yourself over what you're going to eat, of restricting and binging or restricting and restricting for those sort of rare people who, for whom restriction just begets more restriction. And then the negative health outcomes that come with that, you know, hormonal irregularities, missing periods, osteoporosis, heart problems, acne, thinning hair, all that stuff, you know, like whatever it is for you, whether it's those physical things, whether it's the emotional, whether, you know, for most people, it's a combination. It's like the way that it interferes in relationships, the way that it interferes with your ability to be present in your work, in your life, with your kids, with your friends, with your whatever, you know, like, I can't do this. The bad is outweighing the good, you know? And then when they get into recovery enough of a ways, I definitely find that they'll kind of forget about the bad stuff. It's not as immediate or as present to mind. And then they'll be like nostalgic for those good old days of dieting, you know? And that's a tough part of recovery, right? That's a crossroads. And I think people can, you know, sometimes loop back into dieting and disordered eating at that point because they haven't quite like put that last nail in the coffin of it yet. And sometimes that's what needs to happen, right? Like relapse can be part of recovery or part of the process of healing. There's lots of little moments where it could kind of go either way for a lot of us. And just recognizing that and recognizing like, it's not bad. There's nothing wrong with you if you do go the way of falling back into diet culture at that point. Like it's information. It just gives you more information to know, okay, like maybe you have to do that in some cases to really know, yeah, this really doesn't work for me. This all the stuff, all the problems that I had before when I was doing disordered eating behaviors are still there. And now I know for sure that I want to be on this path of recovery.
And now the tables turn and Christy Harrison interviews me about being a fitness influencer back in my day before realizing how toxic it was and that self-acceptance is the only way to heal.
So I'd love to start off by talking about your experience being an influencer. Like you've mentioned, it was kind of before influencing was even a thing. And you had a fitness account and became an influencer at the age of 16 and competed in these bodybuilding and bikini competitions. So I'm curious, like how you got into all that and what that did to your relationship with food and your body.
Starting off early on social media during puberty, the most formative years of my life, struggling with an eating disorder, and at the same time, trying to put forth this facade of, look how great I'm doing, and look how much I'm working out, and how healthy and, quote, clean I'm eating, and this perfect body that I'm putting out on stage in a bikini. My whole account revolved around glamorizing my disordered eating and poor relationship with food. It's sad to admit that I was one of those people that I am now so against, you know, the people that promote woo-woo wellness solutions and that have this very narrow definition of health and beauty and wellness for that matter. It was a long journey to realize that, like, what I'm doing was wrong, not only for myself and my own well-being, but for my whole audience and like the people that I was promoting this for. Hopefully,
what we can keep coming back to is just pure self-acceptance, that even if you're struggling, there is also so much right about you. Even the struggle is right about you. Like, it is absolutely human to struggle. Life is struggle. Maybe a lot of the pressure that you're putting on yourself to not struggle is also what's creating the struggle. I think the only solution is self-acceptance first, and maybe reconsider being online and reconsider going on that diet or buying all these books that you think might fix you. Maybe there's a way to be with yourself first and putting that energy in before looking for places to fill that void for you.
So well said. And it makes me think about the difference between the kind of letting yourself be that you're talking about and just letting yourself, truly accepting yourself, and then the incentives created by social media and just capitalism in general, I think, that make us feel like we always have something to have to fix and to change and to prove, and that we would be better off if we took these supplements, or we'd be better if we did this beauty routine or whatever it is, and how easily we can sort of be pulled into that kind of thinking, especially when we're vulnerable, especially I think for me and for so many people who've struggled, it sounds like you too, you know, struggled with mental health challenges or struggled with chronic illness or struggled with anything where, you know, you're seeking answers. I think we can be so vulnerable to these messages that, like, if you just do this, it'll be fixed. If you just buy this product, if you just do this protocol, this cleanse, this detox, this diet, whatever, that's going to solve all your problems. There are certainly failings of the conventional healthcare system, but I think one thing that wellness culture does is sort of steps into that void and says, like, I can fix it. We can fix it. You just have to do all of these things in order to fix it. And so it takes us away from accepting ourselves and maybe finding some measure of acceptance for whatever's going on for us and a way to, like, live with the ebb and flow of symptoms or whatever, and instead puts us on this hamster wheel where we're just constantly running to try to fix the thing and do all these protocols and practices and take all these supplements and diets and whatever that push us further away from ourselves.
And then eventually I had to throw my hands up in the air and be like, you know what? I cannot keep on restrictively dieting, because the more I try to diet and the more I push myself to stay in control, the more I lose control. And I realized that this is basically the laws of the universe. What you resist will persist, which is why a lot of dieting doesn't work, because not only are our bodies smart enough to know that, like, hey, we don't like famine. We don't want to starve. We want to keep you healthy. But also emotionally, it's like telling a toddler no, right? Like, have you ever told a toddler no? What happens? They want it even more. And that's why you feel heightened cravings. You feel more anxiety around food, and you just feel out of control around food, because anytime you try to restrict, that thing will just persist and it'll just keep yelling at you. So eventually I gave up dieting altogether, and I did gain a lot of weight. I gained over 50 pounds in like 2 months, and it was really tough. It was probably one of the hardest things that I had to go through, even though I've been through so much trauma in my life. For some reason, gaining weight was one of the hardest things, because gaining weight in a society that tells you that that's the worst possible thing that could happen to you is really difficult. It's just one of those things that, like, people do comment and you feel uncomfortable in your skin. And it's really tough looking in the mirror and feeling like you gave up everything you worked so hard for. And that's the unfortunate reality of it. But the very hopeful reality of it is that when you let yourself gain weight, your body does come to a healthy place where you were meant to be all along. And if you read up on chronic dieting, you know that when you diet, you actually tend to yo-yo and gain back even more weight than you lost. So chances are you will be at a higher weight than you're used to, but eventually your body will settle in. You will learn to accept that, and you will be very grateful for this vessel, even if it's not
a size double zero, because your body really does a lot for you. And anytime you feel like it's fighting against you, it's actually fighting to save you, to keep you alive, and to make sure that you are thriving as you are on this planet. So even if you feel like, oh, I'm going on this harmless diet, and at the same time, other areas of your life are being sacrificed, or you can't seem to focus on things that used to like bring you so much joy, or you're not spending, you know, really quality time with the people you love, then chances are you're getting stuck in this vicious cycle and it is getting in the way of your life and you need help and you need to get out. I am very against dieting. I'm very against diet culture, especially, which is this idea that society has just brainwashed us to believe that we have to constantly be dieting, that our sole purpose in life is to lose weight, pay bills, and then die sometime along the way. And that everything about a woman that is important is her appearance. That is the most important thing that a girl can be is pretty. And the most important thing that a woman can be is attractive. And I just hate this. I hate these messages. I hate diet culture. I hate beauty culture. And just as a caveat, I'm not talking about like if you put on mascara that that's beauty culture, or if you decide to eat a salad because that sounds delicious and nutritious. That's not diet culture. Diet culture is when you're doing things because you feel like you should, because you feel like you're nothing without them, because you're scared that other people won't like you or they'll judge you or they'll reject you if you don't look a certain way. That is diet culture. It really messes with our minds, our bodies, our souls, our spirits, everything. And it just makes us believe that all we are a body, and we are so much more than a body.
That was from an older episode where I recount my entire eating disorder story, from struggling with bulimia as a teen to finally recovering in my 20s. And I initially hesitated to include this clip because the audio is not perfect, but there's something so raw and real about it. So if you'd like to hear the whole story and won't be triggered by it, the link to both the podcast version and the respective YouTube video is linked for you in the show notes description. And now let's shift gears into talking about the most shame-ridden aspect of my eating disorder, the hardest part to recover from for a lot of us, and that is binge eating.
Binge eating is something that ruined my life for almost a decade. I struggled with bulimia on and off, and for those of you who have experienced that or know about it, one big aspect of bulimia is not just restricting and purging, but also binging. And that piece of binging, even after I was like in recovery, like feeling like I was finally nourishing my body, feeling like I was understanding what it meant to accept myself and not chase after this perfect image that I had always wanted, I still felt like the binge eating piece never clicked for me until I started telling myself this one thing. And just a quick backstory, I went into recovery in late 2016, and there was a lot going on in my life. So I moved to a different country, I started a new school, I was in a new relationship. And all through this, I was just trying to find my stride in recovery. And I kept doing that dance, that cha-cha, where it was like one step forward and then two steps back, until eventually the cha-cha turned into one step back and then two steps forward. But even through all of this, I was so sick and tired of the emotional roller coaster that binge eating would put me on. I knew in my head that I had to stop restricting, to stop binge eating, but every single time it felt like binge eating was the part that was the most devastating, the most shame-filled, the thing that would just set me back the most and get me sent back into that spiral of self-flagellation and self-loathing. So there's a lot that I had to learn about, like what was going on with my brain, what was going on with my body, biochemically, metaphysically, like there was so much there. So it wasn't until I started telling myself, what if I just let myself binge? What if I just let myself eat all the food in large quantities, cereal and butter. There's so many little binge foods that I had. What if I just ate the whole goddamn bag of chips and fuck it? what if I let myself do it? And what if I didn't let it mean anything about me? And it wasn't until I started giving myself that type of self-talk that I was able to let go of binge eating for good. It really did feel like overnight I stopped binge eating as soon as I told myself that I was allowed to do it. And I think the logic behind this is multi-layered. I think firstly, it's about letting go of that shame. Just being like, okay, this isn't like the worst way ever to cope. This isn't anything to feel awful about. This is, you're just eating food. Like, who the fuck cares? Like, taking that huge weight off of it. And it's one of those things that, like, the more energy and focus and attention and the more you resist, the more it will persist. So if you keep trying to tell yourself, like, I need to stop, I'm going to use willpower, like, you've already done all of that. You already tried the diets, you already tried the willpower, you already tried the intuitive eating, but stopping when I'm full and eating only when I'm hungry. You've already tried the strict rules, you tried the arbitrary rules, you tried the spiritual, okay, in tune, you've tried faking it. You've tried those things. And so for me, the only thing that I did not do was just let myself do it. Just let myself binge. And as soon as I said, okay, Mary, like, here you go, binge this box of cereal, my brain and my body was just like, why? I don't want to. Now that I can, I don't want to. And I think this is where we get like very like primal. I don't know. It's like telling a toddler no. They start rebelling, they start kicking and screaming and throwing a tantrum. And I think we do the same thing. Like, if you tell me no, I'm going to want that thing more. But as soon as I heard like a yes and it's okay and utmost self-compassion and me to me, I'm here for you. That's when it just kind of shifted in me. I was like, all right, like I can do it, but now it's not that appealing. The novelty factor wore off, the tabooness, the like admiring something or wanting something that you can't have, like all of that just like faded away literally with that one sentence self-talk. But the catch is that you have to be very authentic with it. And for me, it was like going through recovery, knowing these things, like really having this be as the last resort. So maybe you have to kind of get there. Like, you have to get to a point where you're like, I don't care. Like, throw my hands up in the air. I've tried everything else. Let me just try this. Perhaps this is not something that will work if you're like early on in your journey, but I invite you to try it at least and experiment. Like I said, you've probably tried a lot of other things. So if you're struggling with binge eating or anything for that matter, this is where I get really passionate about what I talk about in terms of like food and body image and self-love and how expansive it is into other areas of your life. Like, what else are you resisting? What else are you beating yourself up for that is not that bad? Like, are you spending hours of your day self-flagellating over that one cringy thing you said last week? Are you beating yourself up for sleeping in or taking a midday nap or not having the energy to do the dishes? Like, are you wasting your energy doing that? And what would happen if you just surrendered to it? What would happen if you stopped resisting? Because that thing will probably stop persisting the second that you just like let go. Try it. Let me know. See where else it can apply in your life. See if there's other things you're beating yourself up over and getting barricaded in blankets of shame for absolutely no reason. For what? Doing the best you can with what you have and what you know. Like, come on, you're doing great. And all this stuff that feels so consuming now, it will pass. But it'll pass through you a lot more easily if you take a breath and give it that energetic space to move. If you're like tight like this and trying to push it away and trying to resist and use willpower and manipulation, all this trickery that we try to do with ourselves, then guess what? You feel that like tightness in my voice. It's just going to permeate through you harder. It's just going to get stuck in your body and your mind and your brain. It's going to become obsessive. I'm wondering if there's some way that we can just like, all right, fuck it. I'm going to binge and see if that energy, that urge to binge, right? Because all it is a dysregulated nervous system really needing to be taken out somewhere to get re-regulated. Unfortunately, the method and the vehicle might not be like the most supportive thing ever, but it's what feels the most accessible and the easiest in that moment. So I'm wondering if we can just like take a moment to let that urge like pass through you, and you might still want to act on that urge. Again, depending on like where you're at in your journey, what's going on, it's obviously all so unique and intricate. Or maybe that urge to binge just needed to be felt. Like maybe you just needed to acknowledge it and say, okay, like, thank you so much for that. You can do that if that's what you think is best. Brain, body, like I can binge if that's what I need to do. Tell yourself like it's okay and give yourself that unconditional permission. And just out of curiosity, again, because you got nothing to lose, see if that might be an alternative and if that might work. Remember how I mentioned that fighting the urge to binge is like telling a toddler no? Well, therapist and nutritionist Ryan Prentice shares a similar perspective. You often say that it's not about the food. What is it about then?
I get that question all the time, right? It's like, what do you mean it's not about the food? If we look at food as the solution, the binges as the solution. And I know that sounds like the wildest thing, so hear me out. For someone who is having such a hard time is not saying it about the food, I always love to ask the question, if you didn't have food to blame, what would you have to face instead? Because food is such an easy thing to grip onto as the almost easy in quotes thing that if I just change, if I just fix, if I just get right, then everything in my life is going to get better. But when we take a step back and we zoom out and we look at what the food is really doing for you, because you wouldn't be using the food, whether it's an emotional way or whether it's in a binge way, if it wasn't giving you something. And so it's not just you're eating because you love the food. If it was about the food, it would be, I just love like the taste of food and I love enjoying food and I love eating food. And I have people say, but I do, like, I can't stop eating because it tastes so good. And you need to look at how you're experiencing the food in those moments. Like, yes, it tastes good, but like, are you like embracing that it tastes good? Is it, this is so good? Or is it so good because it's letting you turn off? Is it so good because it's giving you a dopamine hit or because it's allowing you to escape or focusing on something else, or you don't have any other pleasure in your day? So this is like the one time that you get pleasure. So if it's not about the food, it's about escape. It's about avoidance. It's about meeting your needs. And that's really tough, because if it's not about the food and it's about that, then that's a much bigger thing to work with, to work on, and to tackle.
I think for me, if it's not about the food, if it wasn't about the food and I didn't have food to blame, I would say it feels so good because it's forbidden and because I feel rebellious. And I like that.
It's the one time you get to turn off. It's like you're trying to be in control all day long, all day long, all day long. And I always give the analogy of like the kid who grew up in a really, really strict home and then goes to college and goes crazy. It's like, it's because all of a sudden, like all the limits are off, all the rules are off. And it's like, F it, right? You only say F it if there's something to say F it to. What are you saying F it to? The rules, the control, the having to be perfect, having to stay in line, the discipline, all of it. And it's the time that you get to be free. And when you take that band-aid off or you take that layer off and you're already there, it's like, well, I've already blown it. So I might as well go 100% in. And that part feels liberating, almost exciting. The high of that too, like the high of the planning the binge, getting the food, having all the food, eating it, and then
the whole thing we tell ourselves about this being the last time. And okay, I've gotten it completely out of my system. And thank God I ate all that food. So now it's not here anymore. And then it's like, okay, here we go. Here's the diet. This is going to be the time that I get everything right. And I never do this again. And my life is going to be changed. But because it was never about the food, and because just saying I'm never going to binge again isn't enough to never binge again, keeps happening.
Part of learning your hunger and fullness cues is to sometimes overeat so that next time you know what feels good and what doesn't. Next time you kind of know your threshold or your limit or how much of something you like to eat before it starts feeling uncomfortable. And also, even people who have been intuitively eating for a while, they still overeat sometimes. Like, it's totally normal. Again, part of intuitive eating isn't just this physical thing. And it's not necessarily eating when you're hungry and stopping when you're full. Like, yeah, that's a part of it. But there's also this big part of it that sometimes eating is emotional. Sometimes cake tastes good and you want a second slice. Sometimes you want to kind of like veg out on the couch and eat a bag of chips, and you probably ate the whole bag. And now you're like, ugh, I shouldn't have ate the whole bag. But you're not going to beat yourself up over it because it's just freaking chips. It doesn't decide your worth. They tasted good. And in an hour, you'll feel better. So just move on with your life and watch Netflix peacefully. That is the self-talk that I embody when I'm eating chips on the couch. So maybe the next day I'm like, okay, the full bag of chips didn't feel so good. Maybe I kind of stop myself at half a bag and see how I'm doing. But I'm doing it in a very gentle, self-compassionate kind of way, not like, oh my God, Mary, I can't believe you ate those chips. You should have known better. Now you feel like shit, you know, and all of that self-talk that goes with it. Like, overeating or mindless eating or munching and crunching on something just because it's yummy is totally normal. So don't beat yourself up for overeating. That is disordered, and that is diet culture talking.
By now, you probably know that the antidote to disordered eating is intuitive eating. Here's Elise Resch, co-author of the first book, Intuitive Eating, originally published back in the 90s. It's since been updated, and here she is sharing one of the core principles of the intuitive eating approach.
The first is always reject the diet mentality. It has to be the first that we talk about, because you cannot really learn to trust your body, tune into your body, if you have in the back of your mind, yeah, this thing doesn't work. Yeah, there's that diet. I mean, there's always new diets popping up that I'll try. So there has to be a place within someone where they realize that they can never diet again, where dieting is toxic, where dieting is just harmful to them, their physical health, their mental health, you know, every part of them, to their soul. And so they're at this point where they will never go on another diet. And that's why it's always the first chapter. Just as gentle nutrition is always the last chapter, because it almost doesn't even need to be talked about, because by the time someone is fully trusting of themselves, everything works out just fine.
I couldn't agree more. I remember exactly where I was and when I was listening to the first chapter of Reject the Diet Mentality. I was still living in Canada. I just left like a really bad relationship, and I was all alone in this apartment with just this like styrofoam pad I would sleep on. And anyways, I remember getting ready for work or school and having intuitive eating in my earphones. And it was the chapter on Reject the Diet Mentality. And the words that like downloaded into me, the ones that I lived by from then moment on, is no matter what, you will not go back to dieting. It was like always no matter what. And at the time I was really struggling with binge eating, and I would tell myself like, no matter what, you're not going to restrict. And that was just like my little mantra that came from that chapter.
Oh, I'm so glad. So interesting. Even before I wrote the book, the original book, co-wrote the original book, I had this, I'd forgotten about this, Mary. I had this little sheet I would give out to clients, and I called it the eating emergency. I don't know why I called it that, but it was for people who were binging and they didn't know what to do with that. And one of the guidelines on that sheet was, no matter how much you may eat in your binge, you must go back to feeding your body, you know, the next day kind of thing, if that's happening at night, and do not restrict. And I didn't even realize then, it was more of an intuitive thing. I didn't realize how scientifically accurate that was and psychologically accurate.
That saved my life, truly, because I knew that obviously I couldn't stop the binging because it was happening of what felt like outside of my control and obviously for a reason, for survival. Mm-hmm. But I knew the restricting part, like I could vow to eat breakfast the next morning. I could, even though it was like so uncomfortable, so scary, it was like so many tears and it got me through. So I love that. That's the first principle, obviously the biggest one. I have a question for you.
Okay.
I hope it's not too touchy, but I'm wondering what's the like loudest, most prominent criticism you get on intuitive eating, whether that's like, you know, personally or even academically. Yes. I'm sure that's been around. And like, how do you deal with that?
Well, I'm going to tell you a little story that was so painful to me and it addresses your question. Many years ago, I think it was actually during the time that Evelyn and I were writing the third edition, I was signing up for a conference and I noticed in the brochure that someone was speaking on intuitive eating. And I was like, wow, somebody's talking about intuitive eating. So I contacted this person and said, hi, I'm Elise Resch. I'm one of the co-authors of Intuitive Eating. I'm going to be at this conference. I hear you're talking about intuitive eating. And the person said, oh, yes, this is going to be great. You know, please come. Yada, yada. So the night before the talk, I had a flash drive with slides and I thought I'll take a look at them beforehand. And I saw that this person, I'm not using the gender, this person was bashing intuitive eating. And I was shocked. And next morning I went to the room where the talk was. It was standing room only. People were so interested in intuitive eating. And the person brought me in and said, they brought me in and said, oh, sit here, got a chair for me and introduced me as one of the esteemed authors of intuitive eating. And the first slide was a picture of the second edition, actually, with Evelyn and me on there. And then they began to bash intuitive eating. And what their bashing came from was they said they looked in the dictionary and the dictionary, they looked in the dictionary for the definition of intuition and it said instinct. And then they said, well, we all know that we can't eat by instinct alone. Interestingly, as the talk went on toward the end, I think this person was promoting a book of their own. In any case, I left that room. I was so upset. So many of my colleagues and friends came up to me. Are you okay, Elise? And I was really shook by it. And I called Evelyn and ironically, she was going to be on the panel with the same person the following week. And it was very upsetting. So that's actually what led to the true definition of intuitive eating, which is the dynamic interplay of instinct, emotion, and thought. Instinct is one part of intuitive eating. That's the survival brain, the reptilian brain that the dinosaurs had. That's what gets us to eat, like when we're in primal hunger and haven't eaten for many hours. Chemicals like neuropeptide Y are released, hormones are released to get us to eat. And what we think of as binging and being out of control is truly survival. So that's one part of it. But we also have emotions. We have the emotional layer of the brain, which is the limbic or the mammalian brain. And our emotions, one way or the other, can affect our hunger, our fullness. And luckily, we have the cognitive part of our brains, the neocortex, which is what differentiates us as humans from cats and dogs, who are also emotional, but can't talk the way we do. So I think the biggest criticism is, yeah, just tell me I can eat whatever I want. And my instinct's just going to tell me to eat, you know, hot fudge sundaes every day or french fries every day. And the truth is, it's far more complex. It's far more nuanced. Intuitive eating takes into consideration all parts of our brain. So that, I would say, is one of them. The other is the people who are saying, but you can't lose weight on intuitive eating. Well, yeah. I mean, that's the whole point. This is not a diet, and this is the goal of it is not weight loss.
So when it comes to intuitive eating, a lot of people who are recovering from a lifetime of dieting and food rules and restriction and all that stuff, a lot of people believe that the solution is to, quote, find balance, right? We hear a lot about finding balance and everything in moderation. And there's so much talk about this idea of balance. However, my issue, I guess, with the word balance is that balance makes it seem like there's this equilibrium that we must achieve. So it still puts us in this black and white thinking. Even when you think of the word balance, like the first image that pops into my head is a scale. And that's really not what this whole journey is about, because
instead, honoring the seasons and the freedom and the flow and the fact that there are going to be some times of your life where you crave more food or rest or movement. And then another season of your life, maybe it's summer and you're more active and you're excited and energized and movement just feels easier or working hard seems easier. And then in the winter, you go back to hibernating and resting and reflecting. Like, these seasons of our life are so necessary. So if we're constantly obsessed with this idea of balance, then we're always focusing on areas where we feel like we're disbalanced, right? We're like, oh, I ate too much last night, so I have to balance it out and eat less this morning. If you look at balance in the dictionary, it literally says a condition in which different elements are equal or in the correct proportions. Again, that just feels so diety and like body shamingly to me, even though it's just a definition of a word. I get it, it's neutral, but the same words popping up as the ones that pop up in diet culture and beauty standards, like, red flag. In my brain, and maybe yours is different, and that's totally cool, but in my brain, when I'm too focused on balance, then I am ultimately just leading my life by the exact same rules of diet culture, which is that everything must cancel out. I got to keep myself in check, right? Checks and balances. Like, everything is very rigid. And so what I invite you to do instead, and this is a word that has changed my life, and it's a word that I apply especially to intuitive eating, but also in all areas of my life, and the alternative word is harmony. Oh, such a yummy, juicy, pleasurable sounding word, harmony. And harmony, if you look up harmony in the dictionary, the definition that comes up is, you're going to love this, the quality of forming a pleasing and consistent whole. So harmony, and I think it relates to music, or it's mostly used when referring to music, but harmony is this idea that when we are in a state where we recognize that all the pieces of the puzzle come together to form a whole, and that all the ebbs and the flows are just as necessary, that the in-betweens are beautiful, and that sometimes things might feel a little bit wacky, but it's ultimately leading you into this bigger picture, this greater journey of healing and discovery, and just giving yourself that permission. And with that permission comes so much more peace around food, with your body, and in your life. I hope this compilation episode reminds you that recovery is possible, no matter how difficult it may feel at times. I've been through it. A lot of the people you heard from today have also been through it. And there's so much more I could say and have said about eating disorder recovery. So definitely check out the full episodes linked for you in the show notes. By the way, compiling all these clips was quite a big undertaking. So if you enjoyed this format, please take a minute to review the show on Apple, leave a comment on Spotify, and most importantly, share the self-love tea with the women in your life. If you're enjoying our self-love podcast, please take a moment to leave a comment or a review letting me know what your biggest takeaway was. As somebody who works mostly behind the scenes on this podcast, I love hearing from you, and it just keeps me connected to the purpose, which is always to spread the gift of self-love.